It's time for the Packet Pushers Podcast.
Where too much networking would never be enough.
A podcast on the data networking industry. Routing, switching, design, strategies, daily work life, or whatever we find interesting. Are you ready? Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real people discuss events, technology and work life in the networking industry. During a week, we gather articles and various ideas, and then we get together to flap our chins about them. Get comfortable while we get around the workbench and diagnose the problems of the network world with humour, wit and maybe even some technical talent. And speaking of technical talent, our world-class pool of resources are here again this week to do the business. Let's introduce the people on the show today. And, of course, our regular guest, Dan Hughes. How are you and what's been happening, Dan?
I'm fantastic. Thank you, Greg. I've just been on a lovely day out. It's a gorgeous day in Dublin today. Mm-hmm. And just settling in for the evening now.
Ah, let's hope the little boy doesn't give you any trouble while we're on the show. Ethan, what's been happening in your world this week?
This week has been continuing to build my network management station, and the thing I had to walk away from Friday afternoon before I hurt someone or something was trying to get SNMP v3 talking between my management station and a checkpoint box. Checkpoint gives you no documentation whatsoever on how to do it other than here's how you start the service and here's a couple things to configure this and that, but they don't give you any of the specifics about their SNMP v3 implementation.
And
but you know, it's all okay.
That's my experience of Checkpoint. Doesn't work at the start and won't work when you're finished. And our special guest this week is Josh O'Brien from the staticnet.com blog. G'day, Josh. How you going?
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Very well. What's been happening with you this week?
Well, for those who don't know me, I'm a consultant. So most of my time this week has been spent talking data center 3.0 and doing just basic core installations with some new clients. But it's been a busy week.
Yeah? So what sort of data centers? Small, big?
A lot of them are actually education. For whatever reason, it seems like every university is currently going through a rehash with VMware, Hyper-V right now, and also looking at Nexus and the new 10 gig play on their campus. So a lot of that stuff in education right now.
You've been looking at any layer 2 extension stuff, like data center interconnects with layer 2, or are you just looking at standard DC template?
As far as OTV type stuff?
Or even VPLS or EOMPLS using pseudo-wires.
Not a whole lot right now. Most of these are kind of Gen 1 data centers that are just moving into virtualization and bigger bandwidth. So the OTV and the Layer 2 extension stuff's coming in the future.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe we'll get together then and have our argument about that, because I've just been designing Ethernet over MPLS data center interconnects using Ether channel between sites. Been very entertaining. And cheap, might
Very
I say.
Cool.
Yeah, just using existing technologies to do interconnect. And of course, I'm here as well. I'm Greg Farrow from etherealmind.com. I'm supposed to plug my blog myself or my company, but I don't do any of those. So let's just push on with the show. There's a few things been happening in the world this week. So perhaps in the news this week, the big thing is that Brocade has been rumored to be up for sale again. It's been going on for a while. Brocade, of course, is the old Fibre Channel, who suddenly bought the Foundry kit to try and desperately turn themselves into an Ethernet player. Really looking like a fish out of water. They only do networking, only do data center networking with a big storage center on Fibre Channel. I was chatting to a storage guy this week, and I said, why is it that their fiber channel over Ethernet strategy doesn't seem to be doing very well? And they said, it's very hard to sell fiber channel over Ethernet when your salespeople are selling fiber channel. And I thought, fair enough. Ethan, you had something to say about this. What do you think about Brocade up for sale?
Well, I think the interesting question is, who's going to buy them? I mean, who really wants the play? What is Brocade offering that that a suitor is going to look at them and go, I want this, and I want to cough up however many... Well, you suppose, is that a billion-dollar acquisition? I don't know how much that would be to get into Brocade. But it's
big, 4 or 5.
It's really big then,
really
yeah.
Really big, yeah. They've got a lot of money in Fibre Channel. So they've been owning the Fibre Channel space. Their gear is OEM'd by IBM, by Dell. Used to be OEM'd by HP, but HP doesn't buy Brocade anymore since they bought Ethernet.
Of the theoretical buyers that were... have been thrown around in all of this rumor. Dell was one, and IBM also one. Someone to bring in that set of products, and they get some more Ethernet and some more SAN products to better compete with HP was the theory. I don't know if that makes sense or not. If you're an IBM, Juniper, they're not selling storage products yet. Do they want to get into that space?
Well, Josh, you've been doing data center stuff. You've seen some stuff around the stacks. you know, how all the vendors are suddenly pushing the fact that I'm HP servers, therefore you should buy HP networks, and or your Cisco networks, you should buy Cisco servers, or, you know, all this sort of stuff. Have you seen much of that, Josh?
Yeah, actually we have. We've seen a ton of that, especially around HP really trying to make a move around their Flex 10 platform. And I could say a whole lot of things about that, but I won't.
Yeah, like it's crap, but, and it runs like a pig, and it's confusing, and it's hard to use, and it's kind of pointless, and it's horrendously expensive. Other than that?
And that's being nice, actually. So, but...
and by the way, Packet Pushers this week is sponsored by HP.
It's interesting that this comes up, though, because one of the things that makes Brocade interesting, especially around this, is that there is so much deployed. And then you look at the foundry play of it. And I've been in this long enough, especially in data centers, to know that there is actually a lot of foundry being pushed in older data centers. And foundry's got a decent argument for translating configs that you currently have into the next generation gear. As far as the storage side of this, though, it's all over the place. I'm a pure network guy, and I'm having to learn storage on the back end to be able to play in the data center 3.0 in the UCS world. So I think until a lot of this kind of falls out, whether iSCSI wins, whether FCOE wins, whether it's a hybrid or whether there's a brand new protocol, the whole Brocade thing's kind of out in the wind. I don't know that I understand why they're even trying to sell right now. It's not a good time for them.
Well, I'll tell you a story I had. We have a Brocade. I have a data center I'm building right now. We have a Brocade pair of director class switches. And Brocade, the fiber channel industry has this thing called director class, which means nothing can ever fail. No redundant fabrics, power, modules, redundant fans, everything's redundant, absolutely hitless everything. Even beyond, I mean, the Nexus 7000 is a bit half-assed compared to what the Brocade director class is. We bought a pair of them apparently around 3 years ago, and they were priced at just over £600,000. Which is just a shy over $900,000. And now the current price is £250,000, which would be about $375,000. Brocade must be in real trouble if their pricing has dropped to 40% of what it was in 3 years. Their revenue stream's going to be up the wazoo.
Yeah, no, I mean, to my mind, a big bit of it comes down to the sort of the future of proprietary storage protocols. Like, I mean, I know your sort of comment has always been that things like FCOE and FCOT are kind of transitional technologies. So you sort of think, well, okay, maybe in 3 or 4 years' time is FCOE still going to actually exist? In which case, and if it doesn't, then does the whole sort of Brocade side of the Brocade business, if you like, i.e. the non-foundry stuff, does it just become worthless? So are these guys looking at it saying, okay, you've got the foundry stuff, which we could maybe build a business with, and you've the Brocade stuff, which it might be worth nothing in a few years' time.
The whole problem with Fibre Channel is that it's completely and utterly a lossless protocol. So it has no ability to tolerate any sort of loss of packets. Well, it can do. It can lose 1 in 100 million packets and recover from that. And so as a result, we have to expend enormous amounts of money to make our networking lossless. Now, whether you're in Fibre Channel as your native carrier or whether you're using Ethernet as a native carrier, everything has to be lossless. Now, this not only includes the networking, which means all of the inputs, the modules, the backplane switching, the output phase, the supervisor can never drop a packet. If there's a failure, you can't drop a packet in mission-critical environments. This also means your networking adapters have to be 10 times the price of a normal networking adapter because it can't drop it. And your software drivers have to be a whole new class of software quality, which Microsoft hasn't heard of yet. And, you know, everything, the cabling has to be higher quality to ensure that there's an awful lot of money been blown away just to deliver a lossless network. And my preposition or my supposition is in 80% of storage networks, you just don't need that much performance or that reliability because actually you're just using it. And so Fibre Channel doesn't have a future. It's not that Fibre Channel over Ethernet doesn't have a future. I'm sure Fibre Channel over Ethernet's actually, you know, comparatively a really good idea. Instead of building a native Fibre Channel frame switching network as opposed to an Ethernet frame switching network, why not just build one over TCP and let a little bit of tolerance to loss would go and it'll work fine. There's a few niche cases for very high performance storage networking which would continue to use Fibre Channel, whether FCOE or native FCOE, and they're, you know, mission critical trading applications or, you know, whatever it is, and they could use InfiniBand anyway. So what's the point of Fibre Channel if that's the truth?
Josh, and your consults that you've been doing lately for these data centers that are doing their upgrades, are you getting people asking you about Fibre Channel? Or are you getting people asking you about iSCSI? Or what are people looking to for their storage now?
It's either somebody asking us to tell them where to go, or it's people telling us exactly what we're going to install. There's no middle ground right now from what we're seeing. We actually had one client who did all EMC and just went with straight iSCSI NFS across the entire platform, just depending on what app he was running off of VMware. But what we're seeing across a lot of the platform is people just saying, okay, we've never really done this before. How do we do it? And in those cases, it's a best practice per client. I mean, I'm not a zealot around storage. I don't think there's a reason to sell one of these for one reason or the other. It has to fit the price point and the benefit point to the client. The really trick thing about going into clients right now is the fact that the vendors don't have a unified story. Cisco has partnered with EMC. They partnered with NetApp, and NetApp is the only – well, right. to an yeah. extent, yeah.
They've partnered with everybody. They've got a special arrangement with EMC, which is kind of – which is part of an Acadia. They have a joint venture with Acadia, which is basically an attempt to cut the resellers out, of course.
Well, part of the reason I asked that question is because as I was looking reading the article, looking through the notes of possible buyers for Brocade, you know, Juniper's name came up. I don't think of them in terms of storage at all, and it seems like the new data center builds that are going out, how you – unify storage and bring that whole fabric together is a big part of quote unquote the story. How do Juniper doesn't fit into that scheme to my way of thinking? I think of them as more they're trying to get into enterprise, they're working on penetrating into the enterprise, but really they're still a service provider play with their big iron. They have a play in storage, and do they need one to continue to grow their business?
I don't think they really need one. Like if the whole Fibre Channel thing is going to go away anyway, and you know, if there is a sort of move towards more, you know, sensible kind of storage methods, then you know, they could end up spending a whole pile of money here on something that's just going to go away anyway.
Well, it's not proven that Fibre Channel will win the war, is my point here. The Cisco's thrown $1 billion at it, but if they spend $1 billion to take away their major rival Brocade in the networking space, that's money well spent from a marketing strategy point of view. Their Fibre Channel over Ethernet has been a great way to introduce UCS servers to the market as a differentiator. UCS servers don't boot over iSCSI or NFS, but it's coming. So they will have that.
That's the big trick right there. We actually got commit on that, and it was on my Twitter stream the other day from Brad Hedlund that the next generation from, I think it's Emulex, is actually coming with hardware iSCSI initiators, and it'll be in, I think, 2 revs out of the actual UCS manager. And that changes the game, because 6 months ago, Cisco said no iSCSI initiation.
No, today, because it was in their interest to promote their, you know, they spent $250 million buying back Nuova Systems, who was the company who invented FCOE, which was a spin out from Cisco. So Cisco took 30 of their best engineers, threw them out there and said, go and invent us this. And they went off and invented, and then Cisco bought it back for $250 million. So they spent that sort of money developing the protocol. But if that gives them a way of presenting their servers and getting in, which they've successfully done, it certainly looks like Cisco's being taken up as a UCS provider, then that's a strategy worth working for. But the question is, who else is selling Fibre Channel over Ethernet? And of today, outside of Cisco, the answer is nobody. So we're all talking about it, right? And, you know, Arista, Juniper, still Brocade's Foundry products aren't shipping with any Fibre Channel over Ethernet support. They've got some bits and pieces dribbling out, but it's hardly a strategy. They're all saying we'll get to Fibre Channel, but I think they're actually holding back and saying, why would we go to all the trouble of putting it in when there's every chance it won't go anywhere? And so if I'm designing data centers, I'm not promoting Fibre Channel over Ethernet because it's still only Cisco. So if you're buying it today, you're buying Fibre Channel over Ethernet from the server, from a UCS server chassis to a Nexus 5000 at the top of the rack. Now, that's a perfectly viable investment strategy in my way of thinking, because that connects, gives you very low-density cabling inside a rack, very efficient, very practical. But in terms of taking Fibre Channel across the Ethernet and going multi-hop across your data center, that's not here, and that's still not going to be here until the middle of next year, probably late next year for even the most foolhardy deployments. Would, you know, who's going to deploy that out of the box unless they've got a really, really big need? I don't believe Fibre Channel over Ethernet's a winner in the long term. Doesn't mean it's not going to be successful in a small way for people who really can't let go or, you know, act as a transition strategy from people who've got $1 billion worth of storage, fiber channel storage, and they can connect that fiber channel storage into their existing Ethernet networks. But in terms of a strategy going forward, wouldn't you much rather use an IP protocol which is much less sensitive to loss, less sensitive to latency, and therefore can survive much more dynamic network conditions and is going to be more reliable in real life than a fiber channel network? And that's my long-term thinking on that.
It sounds like the consensus on this whole Brocade thing is we don't know why there's a rumor that they're going up for sale, because it seems like a bad time for them to be up for sale, and it doesn't seem like the products that they have to offer are something that anyone really is going to want for the long haul. Is that what we're saying?
Been up for sale for 2 years. Nobody's bought them. Dell's the only company. Dell's the only one who needs a networking strategy. They've got low-end switches. They've got no data center. They've been partnered with Cisco forever and just selling Cisco out. IBM keeps rebadging Brocade's gear in the data center, but they equally rebadge anybody else's and probably will their relationship with IBM. Uncle John said a couple of weeks ago that he's very keen to continue his partnership with IBM. In other words, don't go and build a networking team, please. We'd much rather sell our equipment to you. Hitachi NSC, who's the other people, Hitachi this week, there was a group of bloggers over in Japan looking at the Hitachi computer stack. And Hitachi have got a big storage platform, which is much loved by the storage people. And it turns out that in Japan and in Asia, that Hitachi has a very big networking and server strategy, which is very popular. They've just never brought it into mainland America or Europe. And the networking strategy is between Hitachi and NEC. So Brocade's not going to be sold over to there because Hitachi and NEC have already got a strategy. So who's going to buy them? And if you're a customer of Brocade, you'd be thinking twice about whether you would be buying their products on that basis. Mm. Another article that came out this
week. Uncle John might just buy them just to throw it away.
No, he won't. He doesn't.
The way of getting
that.
Rid of a competitor.
They build it. No, he wouldn't do that. He's happy to buy things and then steal various pieces of technology and roll them up into other products. But, you know, why would you when you're number one in that space? What's to buy?
Right.
Which brings me, of course, to our sponsor for the show, and that's Ascolta Training. Ascolta Training is an award-winning Cisco Learning Solutions partner in the United States who offers an array of advanced Cisco courses addressing multiple technologies. Using authorized Cisco course material and a strong customer focus, they provide top-notch training solutions and consistently have the highest customer satisfaction ratings. Ascolta provides training using various delivery methods to easily meet your needs across the US. And in addition to their extensive public class schedule, Ascolta excels at developing and delivering client-specific and customized training to fit your environment. They are partners with Cisco for course development, and with well-known and industry-experienced instructors, they deliver public training courses and private on-site training. Ascolta has a right education solution for you. You can reach them at 1-800-297-4294 or find them on the web, which would probably be better, at www.ascolta.com. They are on Twitter as @Ascolta, and you should follow them for technical content, and occasionally they put special offers with training. Mention the Packet Pushers podcast when you book a class to receive a $250 discount that gets you started. That's Ascolta Training, and they want you to learn something. We like to thank Ascolta for supporting the Packet Pushers, encourage you to get along and listen to them. Another article this week is Cisco Linksys is amongst millions of hackable routers.
I must say, it's a bit of a horseshit article, though, because all they were actually saying is, well, okay, it's not quite all, but they were saying that basically an attacker would effectively be able to proxy themselves through your PC, which is obviously a bad thing. Mm. And the sort of key point being, and if you leave the default password on your little Linksys or whatever router, then, you know, people will be able to break into it. No shit, Sherlock. if you leave the default password on it, you deserve whatever pain you get. I'm sorry, but I have. And I think it's just
a cheap
article, and they just attach the Cisco name to it to maybe get a bit of, you know, to get some idiots talking about it.
That's not fair, Dan, because most people who is a Linksys product really aimed at? Yeah, a bunch of network people use them, but mostly it's the generic home consumer who goes to the local, whatever the electronics shop is in your area, and they grab one and plug it in. And the big poster that they got when they took it out of the box said, plug this cable in here and this one in here, and then you should be able to get on the internet, and if you can't, call someone. So most of these people, do they know how to get in and change default passwords and these kind of things? I'm again gesticulating wildly with my arms.
Yeah, no, about it's a fair point. Like, you see a lot of the routers these days come, especially the ones from telcos, they kind of come with a little sticker on them. So, you know, there'll be a unique default password per device kind of thing. I think there's been that many incidents of sort of, you know, drive-by Wi-Fi hijacking and all this kind of business that, you know, a lot of them seem to have, I guess, kind of got wise to it. You know, there's a unique SSID, there's a unique key for the SSID, and there's a unique admin password. And these are, you know, sort of sensible things. Now, if Linksys is, you know, if the password is still Linksys or admin or whatever it used to be, then yeah, okay, they deserve to be taken out and shot. But
can these guys be patched for this DNS rebinding vulnerability, though, is the question. Is that there's so many devices out there that are vulnerable to this kind of thing. What does it take to get these guys patched, I think, is the question. And what are the vendors doing about that? Because it wasn't just Linksys that was cited. Yeah, they were notoriety because it says Cisco and it's Linksys. And so there is, you know, if it's a hack there, it's news. But how big of a deal is it to patch?
I mean, the hack is effectively the fact that there is a simple to guess password on it. So, I mean, that's the thing they need to fix.
This actually leads to a really interesting question about Cisco and their consumer strategy, that what kind of damage could be done to Cisco if there was, say, a mass hack across a consumer product because it's not managed at an enterprise level. There's some very interesting kind of thoughts around this, actually.
Mm. If you take the bigger stuff as well, their SME stuff, where, you know, it's starting to get almost a little bit more serious and you're sort of expecting a few things, you know, a little bit more from them. So again, if this has this, they make it simple for non-technical SME users to maybe be able to deploy easily. But is that going to then potentially lead to some kind of, you know, easy to socially engineer kind of attack you know, could lead to, and the fact that they've then gone out and they've stuck the Cisco name in big letters all over this stuff. I mean, they have, you know, put their brand on the line with it.
Yes, they have.
It comes down to sales, though, doesn't it? If you've got a router that out of the box, you plug it in and it just works, and that's the reputation it has on the consumer forums and support boards and reviews on Newegg.com and reviews on Amazon.com. Gosh, I unplugged, I took it out of the box and plugged everything in and it just worked and I'm so happy. Versus I unplugged it and I had to go through this setup thing and I couldn't get on the internet and they wanted me to change some password thing and it got all screwed up and I had to call support and I talked to someone who didn't speak my language very well and I got frustrated and angry and I threw it and I took it back and I bought a Netgear instead. I mean, I think that's what Cisco is trying to – how do you find that balance between the consumer without a clue and just getting a product to work for them versus there's a potential for exposure, you know, a besmirching of our company name because there's a great big hack because we've sold a million of these things and they're all vulnerable. I don't know where you find that balance, but I think it's a different set of concerns in the consumer space than the enterprise space. They want to get volume out the door as opposed to selling them based on their reputation solely,
which is why Cisco keeps losing face. I mean, this is absolutely trivial as far as we're concerned, and I think we should move on to the next topic. So the next topic we wanted to look at is that Checkpoint announced their report, reported their results for the second quarter, and they made an astonishing amount of money. You're talking their results talk about a 17% increase in revenue, with 25% increase in product revenues, which means they sold a lot more kit than before, but still sold more professional services and maintenance contracts. Cash flow, so they've obviously managed to close some deals where they got some cash because the cash flow is up 32%. So total revenues for Checkpoint, $261 million. Now, that's a very small business compared to some of the other companies, like Cisco, for example, makes $10 billion a quarter. And yet Checkpoint looms large in the minds of many network engineers because of their bloody firewalls. Now, frankly, my view on Checkpoint products is that if they caught on fire, I'd let them burn rather than piss on them. And it's just they are the world's most brutal product. The only thing they can do well is run an overblown access list with an interface that looks like it was built in 1970. So we did a survey this week where we sent out, Dan sent out a Twitter and I retweeted into my stream to say, is there anybody out there who believes Checkpoint products are actually worth having? And you know what? Not one person wrote back in support of Checkpoint products. So let's go around the table. Checkpoint opinion from Dan.
Well, I suppose Checkpoint, I've been using Checkpoint for a long, long time. It was one of the first products I learned, 3.0b, I think it was at the time. And it has got some advantages. The one thing I've seen argued for by customers is, well, I mean, one is the familiarity play. You know, they've used it for a long time. They know how to drive it. And, you know, the GUI, while there's lots of extra tweaks and knobs on it these days, the basics of how you apply your rules is there. So in the sort of the small business scenario, or in sort of the company where you don't have a dedicated firewall techie, I can see why people like its simplicity to make basic rule changes. The downside to that is it's because it's such a complicated product under the hood, if you like. It's very easy to push a little button on the GUI and cause all kinds of worlds of pain underneath, which you don't actually see. And I suppose that's a generic problem of, you know, trying to do a complicated thing, which, you know, firewalling can be. It has got some fairly clever stuff in terms of its smart defense. Now, most of the places I've ever seen it used, it just seems to get turned off. But
every company I've ever worked with just got smart defense turns it off about 2 months later. Because it never works.
I mean,
it's
back to the old IDS discussion. It's IDS without, you know, having the time to invest into an IDS project, and that's, you know, you can't really blame the product for that.
I can. The big thing they should have a smart defense system that actually works, or has a configuration utility that intelligently walks you through and says, "This is not a bad thing to configure because our product does it this way." Oh, it broke. Wow.
Yeah. The big downside I've found with Checkpoint, and this hasn't changed in my experience over the years, is their tech. I've had nothing but bad experiences with it. The Checkpoint, when it's working fine, yeah, okay, it's grand. I don't like the cost, I don't like various things, but when you have to phone their tech, I have had nothing but worlds of pain from it. And that, to me, is the number one reason why if I go into a place and they have Checkpoints, the first job is to get it ripped out.
Ethan.
Now, what are you saying? What kind of an attack, Dan?
The attack. Operation. Sorry.
For you guys that, you know, only kind of speak English on the other side of the pond, I tell you, it's really hard for us to interpret what you really mean. So, yeah, no, I'm with you. Yeah, checkpoint support, you're saying, is rough. I get that. A lot of experience as a Checkpoint, kind of a high-level admin, hey, deal with NATs, deal with Checkpoint rule bases, deal with those sorts of things. But it wasn't until recently that I got into, here's a new one, take it out of the box and make it go. And then I started to learn how painful life could be. You'd think this wouldn't be hard. But, I mean, there's some fundamental architecture things that I don't love. I don't like the way they license things. They tie licenses to an IP address, so you're trying to migrate a policy from an old smart center to a new one, let's say. A lot of times you can't get the new box to license properly unless you put some kind of a IP address from the old one if you're trying to port things over. I don't like the fact that there's no way you have no option to specifically manage a Checkpoint firewall. You have to have that smart center that's out there somewhere where you're editing policy and then pushing policy to the box.
There's actually a CLI, but it's a whole language that's completely non-intuitive. Like, unlike iOS or Juniper's operating, you know, the Junos operating system or anybody else's operating system, Checkpoint made their own Unix sort of like language that has no. So there is a CLI, you just need to discover it and then hate yourself right thereafter.
I don't know what versions that would fly. I haven't gotten that deep into it. I mean, if you log into an appliance directly with SSH, there's mostly you've got a Unix shell and you've got some menuing that they offer to you in the expert mode. You know, I would agree with Dan that the smart defense can be a challenge because you turn on certain signatures, things that you want the firewall to look for. And again, like not unlike many other IDS products, you have false positives and frustrations just trying to get the thing to work right. If you want to leverage all of these things in your firewall at once, you want to turn on all the smart defense stuff and some of the add-on stuff like URL filtering and anti-spam and so on, depending on the version of code you're running and just how much traffic you're trying to push through the box, you better have it sized a lot bigger than you maybe think you need, because you'll start eating that thing alive if you're putting a lot of traffic through it. It can be a frustration. Their support, I haven't called them a lot, and some of the things I've had to call them on have been, you know, pretty basic stuff where as soon as I found the answer, like, oh, you know, and I was actually the idiot, not the guy in the other end of the phone.
Well, let me just say that in the 5 years that I've had to deal with Checkpoint, I've not had a successful call with their tech ever and ended up solving it myself in every case. I might as well never have bothered with their tech support. In fact, every time I did, I regretted calling them because they're just – the quality is so poor. The people have no idea what's going on. I've spoken to Nokia, who used to run – now that the Nokia hardware has been bought by Checkpoint, hopefully things can get better. But, you know, the Nokia people used to sit there and say to my face, we don't know what to do. Their Checkpoint is just so bad. The reason they're making so much money, as far as I can tell, is because they're not putting in any support. What about you, Josh? You ever used one?
I have never managed one. I've kind of come in and troubleshooted around them and with Checkpoint administrators. And I've tried several times. I'm actually sitting here in my office right now looking at an old Nokia box that we pulled out about 4 years ago from a client site. But back to the licensing issue, I've never been able to get software that I can run stably on it. And I'm pretty good about finding software I need to test things. So this has been kind of a challenge for me just in understanding where to learn it. My time in the government, there was a lot of Nokia in place, but my organization actually went with Pixis and then migrated to ASAs just because we didn't want to get into the Nokia Checkpoint business.
Yeah, I'm the same way. There's a couple of other things that you guys haven't hit on, or if you have, I've missed it. The big one I have with Checkpoint is that their performance is really poor, especially for the price. So if you've got a given performance level in a Juniper firewall or an ASA firewall, multiply the cost by 5 times and multiply the maintenance program by 7 times, and that's how much it'll cost you to buy the same performance for a Checkpoint. They are really expensive.
Checkpoint maintenance is expensive for sure. Yeah, that's something you got to actually factor in looking forward. If I buy all this Checkpoint gear now, what are my ongoing annual support costs going to be?
Yep.
Yeah, it's not insignificant for sure.
It's crazy amounts of money.
Yeah.
So there's a quick interesting point about this. I was working with some of the Cisco BU guys not long ago for the ASA, and there's a lot of Nokia people on the Cisco BU team now. And in 8.3, from everything I've talked to people, is we start seeing a lot of Nokia and Checkpoint type features start coming into the ASA as far as how it's doing NAT and how it's doing some of its policy sets now. So I kind of wonder what the advantages to even going with Checkpoint would be nowadays.
If you've got one, you'll keep it. I've got customers. I mean, I had this discussion just this week. I said, why? I was talking to somebody. He said, why do you have a Checkpoint firewall at all? And he says, well, we bought them back in 1988 when they were running Checkpoint on Solaris servers, and that's what we still got today. And they just can't imagine changing. They think that the risk of changing from one firewall to another is so bad that they just can't face that sort of a project. They're just too lazy. So they'll happily pay over the odds for that firewall instead of changing out. So performance, the other one that I've found is that the documentation for Checkpoint firewalls is abysmally bad.
Yep, I'll give you that. I'm just trying to, like I was saying earlier, trying to do something as simple as nail up SNMPv3. And what they give you as far as how to turn it on is so, it's just the bare bones basic. These are the commands and these are what they do with no details on how, what's actually going on under the hood such that you can get something else to talk to it. Yeah, and this has been true for other things I've been trying to find out, things dealing with site-to-site VPN tunnels, things dealing with VPN client support and the like. There's not – you can download this whole big fat documentation package and you're looking at 20 or 30 PDFs covering all these different areas of the box. A, it's hard to figure out what PDF you want to find the feature you need. And then when you get in there, it's very hard to find enough detail to actually help you solve the problem. The documentation is frustrating.
It's almost as if they went with volume instead of quality and said, well, if we make enough documentation, we'll cover everything eventually. I've had plenty of problems with that. All right. So I guess you've sort of worked out, listeners, that we just love Checkpoint firewalls.
I have one more question along the topics, which if we don't love Checkpoint, what do we love?
Go around the table. Josh, favorite firewall?
ASA right now.
Ethan?
Well, I'm hoping to transition to some Cisco stuff, and we're going to see. I've got some Pixis in production, some older ones, and I've got some ASAs I'm going to put up, and I'm going to have to reserve my opinion till then. I used to teach Pix class back in the day, and then the ASAs come in. I installed a couple of them for a government agency and haven't had much exposure to them since because of a job I had a while back where it was all Checkpoint. Going forward, we'll see. Not sure yet.
Dan?
It's got to be ASA for me. Mainly for the familiarity, but it's the one I've used the most.
Well, I'm Juniper. NetScreen OS or SRX. Absolute choice. Mm. Once you've used one of those, you'll never go back to an ASA. You'll realize how limited and poor quality the ASA is, particularly if you're using – the ASA is a pile of junk compared to the Juniper stuff.
No, I wasn't that taken with them, to be honest with you. I mean, they seem great. Maybe it's, again, it's just down to familiarity. And, you know, I wrote a blog post on this a while ago with, the best firewall is generally the one that you know best because it's the one that you're going to make fly. And for me, that's the ASA. I suppose for the NetScreen, I was kind of modeling my way around it. Maybe if I'd actually put the time into learning it really well, then I'd agree with you.
And this is a good point to leap off to this week. You'll remember a couple of weeks ago I talked about an iOS petition, and if you haven't already come to etherealmind.com/petition and put your name on there, please do so. We're collecting signatures on a genuine sort of like a political style petition to actually go back to Cisco and say, please give us licensing for being able to do educational and training on. For me, it's becoming a real problem because I need to do some testing of the iOS 15 release train. And it's almost impossible for me to get my hands on some 3,800 routers just to be able to play with, especially when I need to build a network with 10 or 15 routers, and I need access to that. If I can't design that next-generation network, I'm probably not going to buy Cisco. I'm probably going to go to Junos, who do have emulation software. And if you think that is part of your world for CCNA, CCNP training, you need emulation. Or if you're someone with a Nexus, Cisco also has a emulator for their Nexus platform called Titanium. They have been considering whether to release it into the new market, so this is your chance to make your voice heard and ask for Titanium so that you can have NXOS emulation and do testing and change validation before it goes live. So come along, etherealmind.com/petition, and make your voice heard. I'm attempting to get in contact with people to try and see if Cisco is going to give us an official response. I haven't been very hopeful about what's been happening in the space because I've been trying to get in contact with Cisco Press for some time. Please, if anybody's from Cisco's listening, please get somebody from Cisco Press to get in contact with me. There's a number of things that we need to talk to them about. Yeah, I agree. If you've ever done training on checkpoint firewalls, it's a real challenge.
Well, I wanted to ask you why you like the Juniper / NetScreen stuff so much. Is it the interface? Is it efficiency and how they monitor traffic? Why do you love it?
Reliability. The ASAs are not reliable. I found under very heavy load, the ASAs will consistently throw their toys out of the cot, reload, run memory leaks. And if you do anything too far away from core or mainstream, the ASAs are very unstable. I haven't had any great. I've been checking out the bug reports lately on the ASA, and they're still having memory allocation problems. They still throw. So if you run them in high performance environments, for say you're on a 10 gigabit and you're running 5 or 6 gigabits per second through them, they're just not ready for the big time. They're a little toy firewall built for SME, nice for vast. You know, if you've got large numbers of small sites, they're going to work well. But if you need to do serious firewalling as a key gateway, the Juniper NetScreen and the software is absolutely rock solid stable. You can create virtual systems, delete virtual systems, create virtual routers, delete virtual routers. You can do all the things you can. And you know what? When you click that button, that thing does exactly what it says it does. There's no tricks, there's no caveats, there's no, oh, you can only do this when the sun's in the right-hand side of the sky and you're throwing salt over your left shoulder and you're running the right version of code after you've asked attack to do a bug check for you. You know, NetScreen doesn't have any of those sorts of problems. It just comes out of the box and it just does what you want it to do.
Well, we have pleasing. A first on the Packet Pushers podcast. Greg Farrell likes something. All right. Mark it down.
Very harsh. So let's jump away from abusing Checkpoint because it is something of a hobby of mine, and just quickly jump to the fact of the week. So the fact of the week this week is that on the 10th of October 2010, the year will be 10-10-10, which is, of course, 42 in binary. And, of course, 42 is, from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
And everything.
Which always begs the question, what was the question? Next time the boss tells you that this is the answer, ask him what was the question. I wanted to cover, we've had a lot of discussion, a lot of feedback from our listeners this week, and it's been great to hear from what you've got to say, with a number of questions being asked around the career development. And it's been a hugely popular piece of the podcast. So we're going to run on with it a little bit more today, and then we expect to carry this discussion into future episodes. Just after the last show, we had somebody wrote into us and said, I've been a CCIE. I've done everything that I can need to do, but I would want to go back. I actually want to stay on the tools. I actually want to be configuring something for a living. But my only way to get more money and to get more to develop my career is to go into management. And I've made the decision to head down that path. Personally, you know, I think that I call that taking a walk to the dark side. So let me give you Ethereal Mind's view on the different view between management and engineering. I believe that there's only two types of jobs in the world, those people who do and those people who talk about it. And my managers, my project managers, business managers and executives spend all their day jibber-jabbing about the work that needs to be done and making sure. Now, don't get me wrong, that's valuable work and it needs to be sorted out. But there's a world of difference between jibber-jabbing and setting soft targets. And, you know, you can always, as a manager, say that a project is successful by saying it's successful and accepting risks or saying that that's good enough, or we can just say, well, that's good. Whereas it's very different over on the engineering side where you actually have to do something. And in our world, things either work or don't work. It's a binary flip. Did you get that done? Yes, that's done. You can't say, define the word done. Our world will shift it a little bit and then jibber-jab about it and come and see what we come out with. So for me, taking a walk to the dark side is something that may happen in my career in the future. But when I had to make that decision 10 years ago, I chose to stay on the tools, and that's been good for me. What do you guys think about? Has anybody here thought about going into management?
I've done it three times. I'm done with that, I think. I don't really want to go back to that. It's funny what you were saying about the guy who wrote in and said, "Hey, to get any more money, I don't have a choice. I have to go into management." Yep, been there, had that exact thought process, and then went forward into that. And it's just not me. Greg, what you were saying about, are you the guy that wants to sit there with the equipment and make it go, you know, resolve a problem, configure something so that it, you know, it now accomplishes what a design was? Actually having your hands on the equipment is such a different thing from being a manager, where you're at least one step, if not more than one step, removed from it. And it's a personality thing. If you are well suited to management, and there are definitely those people that are good at it, you know, great. If you want to be the geek engineer architect type that's you know, got his elbows you know, right up inside a router all day long, then that's a different thing, and that's not a management track. It maybe that's a technical team lead, but it's not a management track, not as such. I don't want to go back there. I've done it enough, and what I have found has happened is, you as the manager of a technical group of people, you want to still have the hands-on and be doing that, but you just don't have time. You're dealing with personnel issues. You're dealing with a whole lot more meetings than you normally would have. You're dealing with vendors and budgeting and other kinds of things like that, that if what you really love is making the equipment go, all that stuff is tedious very quickly and frustrating because you didn't get done at the end of the day what you'd hoped to.
Yeah, I remember being a team leader for a while and worrying about people's leave application forms, and one of my colleagues was arguing with his wife and that was affecting his work output and all that. I just couldn't be bothered with any of that. Dan, you've been in leadership roles before?
Yeah, I did a couple of roles where I was more hands-off. And sort of one of them actually was the Special Olympics when the World Summer Games were held in Ireland, which is the first time it's ever outside of North America. I was the network manager for it. The most interesting project I ever did, I have to say. But completely hands-off. Absolutely hands off, because one of our sponsors was you know, providing all of the networking resource, if you like. And no, not for me, thanks. As you say, you know, it's the you need to be able to actually get on and do things. And I was laughing at what you said there, Ethan. The you know, the manager who still wants to be doing it. I was laughing at my current manager the other day, and I'm sure all of you, when you go into your offices on Monday, you'll see exact same thing. The manager who has the out of date books on his desk still, or on the shelves next to his desk. He still wants to. He's still got that urge. And you look there, and you know, it's the sort of, you know, the CCNA from, you know, 1863 or something.
He's got the CCNA textbooks from 1989 on his desk.
Exactly. I find it quite sad, actually. It's not sad. I mean, you know, obviously they've moved on, but it's that kind of holding on to. I was technical once.
Yeah.
And I used to work for a telephone company, and my manager had been a PBX engineer in his day, as it were. and he could still bore you to tears with vast amounts of detail of some phone system he'd installed back in, you know, 1932.
I've heard those stories. Oh, man. I had a manager once who would always tell me how technical he was because of the Novell 3 stuff he'd done. And this was after Novell, long after Novell was relevant. Oh, boy.
The Tech Field Day in September that I think all of us are going to. Sorry, Josh. I mean, Ethan, Dan, and myself. Ivan and I start talking about Token Ring and ArcNet and DLSW and, you know, bridging and stuff, I'm going to make sure you guys are right there to listen and be a part of that plan.
But that's different because at least it's somebody doing a technical comparison of, you know, what it was then to what it was now, you know, what the pros and cons were, as opposed to, you know, it just stopping after what they did in 1963. On the original point, the guy who, you know, can't basically earn any more money without going to management, I'd take one little point on that. You know, there are always options, and I mean, one of them is to do what you do, Greg, and go consulting. You know, where you can basically earn more money. You have to sell your soul a little bit, but you know, there is sort of reasonably good money to be had there if you're that good, and if you are actually capable of going out and getting these gigs, then, you know, there is actually a career path down that way. The other thing is, I mean, and I have to say that the one thing about one thing that's fantastic about the company I work at right now, some companies do actually have career paths for technical people. So, you know, if you go to a company which values, you know, which is basically a technology company, you might actually find that there are options there. Now, obviously, it depends on where you are in your life and whether you want to move to somewhere, you know, and these kind of things. But I don't think it's as simple as to say, I've hit a glass ceiling. I can't go anymore without crossing over. Maybe you can't in your current company, but there are always options available to you.
My view is if you're working for a company that values managers over engineering skill, which says which values jibber jab over the execution. So if you're working for a business that wants to spend more time in meetings and arguing over the color of the paint job in the cafeteria, that's probably not a company that you want to be working for. I've been in meetings where they took 4 hours to debate how to put people's desks in a given area. And at the end, I just wanted to poke my eyes out. Those sorts of businesses are places, if that bothers you, you know, if arguing over the color of the router scheme or whether the cables should be run to the left side or the right side in the rack bothers you, then you really need to think about changing jobs. However, let me come back to what you said. You said before, Dan, about people being consultants, and I'm going to ask Josh what he thinks about this, but I am under the view that being a consultant in some countries is not as possible or practical as you think. Because, for example, in Australia and the UK, when we leave, we get health insurance from the government. But in the USA, you can't get health insurance unless you're able to buy your own. And most companies need to work for a company to have health cover and a 401k pension plan, and that drastically limits a lot of people's choices. Josh, you said before that you were a consultant. Who do you work for? You work for yourself or...?
Yeah, I'm actually working for a VAR, for a gold VAR here in the U.S. That covers kind of northern part, eastern part of the country. So, yeah, your point to needing the health coverage and that kind of stuff is a big challenge. But I agree totally that, you know, if you're looking to kind of uncap your salary, you've got to look beyond the normal enterprise because you do hit that ceiling. And I was in government prior to this, and you just kind of hit this – you know, arbitrary number that makes no sense when you're doing 90% of the work that, you know, people are taking credit for. But the really interesting thing about it, even in consulting, at least within a VAR, I found that there's a real cap to where you can be financially. But what I found that's a really uncapped opportunity within consulting is pre-sales engineering. And that, for most people, sounds really kind of sketchy. But from my perspective, there's not many good pre-sales people out there. I don't care if they're with the big vendors or if they're with a VAR or whoever. It's just simply a fact that people go in and talk what Cisco has to talk about. But if you can go in and architect and then help implement that on the back end, there is huge value in that. And a lot of pre-sales guys are incentivized like sales staff, not like engineers.
Yeah, I've been in pre-sales and it was a great experience in the sense that for me, the thing that I learned from my career about being in pre-sales was how to communicate, how to structure a deal, how to close the customer, so how to manage the sales cycle from an engineering point of view. And that for me has been a key factor in my success as an independent consultant, in that I actually now work in my own limited company and represent myself directly to end users and have done for 10 years. And that pre-sales experience let me know how to structure a deal, negotiate, close a deal, do invoices, you know, in-progress invoicing, stuff like that. And you can learn a lot from that with Inside. One of the topics that we will carry forward into a future show is working for a reseller and what that life is like. But for today, you know, you can leave the company that you're in. Guys, if I've got some advice to hand out to young people today, it's don't spend all your money. Keep some money back in your pot so that you can walk away from the job and look for another one, and you've got some transition money to keep in the middle. And I mean, you know, by all means in your life, go out and spend all your money to buy a new house and make yourself poor, but start building up a safety buffer of cash so that if your company goes down or if your company just doesn't need you anymore, and I've said this in previous shows, make sure you've got something there so that you can walk away from a month to 6 weeks to 2 months and make a decision about where you want your life to be. I want to go back to the one topic that we may not get enough time to cover in full, but we were having a discussion, a bit of a twit piss on Twitter this week about how much redundancy do you need in a Nexus 7000. Particularly, I was talking about having two switches, and if you have two Nexus 7000s, you need two power supplies in each. And in fact, depending on the power load, you might need three in each. And then you need at least one supervisor in each, and then at least one module in each, and then you need at least N plus one fabric in the back if you're going to have fully redundant. Now, the question is, if you've got two switches on either side, do you really need to have two supervisors in the left, two supervisors in the right, and then spare redundant fabric modules in the left and the right, and redundant power supplies in the left and the right? Or are you just pissing money down the drain buying more equipment than you really need? Now, Josh, we particularly got you on the show to have a shot at this one, so tell us why you think you need it or not.
I think in a lot of cases you actually don't need it. As soon as you have dual chassis, you actually end up with the opportunity to be able to, you know, have a full failure and converge the network to one side or one or the other, which is the whole point. We've had that all the way back through HSRP and VRRP and all those things. The trick is, though, is in the event that you don't have a dual chassis, the dual supervisor, especially in the 6Ks and the 7Ks, we don't have any type of hitless upgrade capability, and that becomes the real challenge there.
Aren't there some networks that can get by without a hitless upgrade? So, for example, in years gone by, we had the thing where you upgraded the left switch, and you know everybody's data failed over to the other pathway, and away it went. And then you waited a while, a month or two, and then you upgraded the other one. You know, or maybe you did them within 2 hours of each other. Whatever you did. My point is that Cisco's out there banging on about the fact that you need to buy redundant power supplies, redundant fabrics, redundant supervisors, and redundant modules. And bugger me if they've managed to squeeze an extra 125,000 out of you. Per chassis, by the way. You know, is it?
Yeah, it seems crazy to me. I mean, the idea of having two seems to be a much better use of money than having, you know, all these extra bits and pieces in them. I mean, if you're going down the resiliency route, you know, as you say, you're going to have a left switch and right switch. And the whole point is that one of those two switches can take the load if the other one craps out. So if you're accepting that and you're designing on that basis, you know, put the thing on a decent level of maintenance that you can get your 4 hour spares or whatever. And in the highly unlikely event that a supervisor actually blows up on you, then yeah, okay, you're down for 4, 5, 6 hours on that one side. It's not actually going to be service affecting. If you want to do your upgrades, as you say, Greg, you know, you just do a traffic shift, do your upgrade, go on. I don't see the point of not, you know, I don't see why you would spend the extra money on the second supervisor or the extra power supply.
I think a lot of this comes down to, Greg, something that you alluded to when you were talking about this. What sort of a data center is it? What are you supporting? There's data center environments that I've worked in where, because of the nature of the traffic flowing through the network, anything that could be done to minimize a hit, no matter how transient that hit, no matter how small, few number of seconds it was going to be, we'd go down that road. So it wasn't just two switches. It was two switches, and it was the multiple power supplies, and it was multiple power supplies spread across the power inputs in the data center, and it was everybody spread out across those two switches, and it was tweaking protocols to make sure that everything converged in a as fast as absolutely possible, because any amount of traffic that would get dropped is not acceptable. So the goal was minimize that traffic drop, minimize that interruption to service.
Sure, I understand that. There's a use case for that, right? So there are networks out there where a two-second delay or an outage of 2 seconds while something is not acceptable, right? But there are equally, in a university campus, networks, for example, where I've been onto network campuses in the distribution layer, where the network can go out for half an hour and nobody cares.
And the data center I work in now, you know, I was given a 4-hour maintenance window where I said things are going to be going up and down just depending on, you know, what I'm working on. And it was like, yeah, it's fine. You know, it was no big deal. So, but it is, there is a case for it for sure.
Yeah. If you make a decision to go down this path and say, look, I could get by without all of these spares because I've bought a second chassis as a spare, you can really save your company serious money. Now, these decisions aren't particularly easy to make, but they can be done.
At the end of the day, you're right. It's totally an architecture decision. But there's a really unique thing with the next generation data center stuff that's coming out, things like the VDCs that give you actually distributed switch and routing fabrics on the 7Ks. And then when you consider that we start wrapping storage up into the 7Ks once FCOE blades are there, and then we have FEX modules that wrap up into the 7Ks, as you start doing this, an actual hitless architecture becomes critical in the fact that you might be affecting edge switches now, and you might be affected your storage bandwidth. It's totally architecture, but one of the things that we have to keep in mind is the more that we virtualize and collapse these chassis in data centers, the more and more critical that these design elements come into for dual soup and dual chassis.
And there's another argument against FCOE.
I didn't mean it that way.
I think my point might be is that in the data center, you might be entirely correct to use redundant fabrics, supervisors, power supplies, and have a whole redundant chassis that's got redundant power supplies, redundant supervisors, redundant fabrics, and redundant line cards. But equally, you might also have in a building or a campus environment, in a multi-story building, as long as you've got two chassis and the failover when you're using, say, standard rapid spanning tree or MST is going to happen in less than 2 seconds, then why have all that redundancy built in? There's nothing to be gained in that particular use case. And in a data center where the data center itself is redundant and designed to fail over within 15 seconds, why bother again? Why go to all the hassle and trouble and bug shooting and installation and maintenance contracts for all those extra modules? Why not just have less product? Because you've got to remember that part of a HA system is the less kit you have in a solution, the more available it is.
Yeah, I mean, part of it's how exposed does the data center environment feel if you do have a switch go out for some amount of time where it's going to be some period of hours before you're going to have that switch back in service again. And again, it's all environment dependent. I've been in an environment where as soon as one half of an HA solution goes out, everybody's really nervous while they're sitting there going, is that thing replaced yet? That thing that replaced that failed. It's up. Are the parts coming in? You call TAC, right? And it's this nonstop barrage of where are we at? How far are we from getting the thing that failed replaced? And on it goes because everybody's nervous that thing that's left is now going to fail or become a bottleneck in some way due to an unexpected problem. So again, there is a case for it. I heard what you were saying about the simpler you make your HA solution, the more you can trust the thing. It's actually going to fail over and work right. And you're right. That's true. Because the more complexity you build into it with your protocols and your timers and do you have to have DNS into failing you over to other data centers? And
I mean, I've had chassis where I've had the dual supervisors actually go split mode, where in the 6500 platform, I had dual supervisors and both of them decided to go active at the same time, or worse, that when one actually failed over, the other one just didn't start at all. And I'm sitting there looking at it going, you know, I just blew up £50,000 on a secondary supervisor and it never worked. Boy, I feel
this
great.
This is a totally another discussion. I know we don't have time for it, but it's the whole VSS discussion too about complexity and simplicity. What happens when you tie those two supervisors together as an intelligent fabric? And there's some very interesting things that can happen there. You're talking about going split brain supervisors. What happens when you have split brain chassis in a unified fabric?
Well, and Cisco's answer to that is spend more money, of course. But yeah, I've just had this argument with my account rep and that sort of thing. All right, well, I think we're just about wrapped for the show. We're starting to run long and I'm running hoarse. So that's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to Packet Pushers. We should be back again in a week or so. Make sure you come back. I'd like to thank our external resources for joining us this week. Josh, tell us about what you're going to be doing this week and a little bit more about yourself and where people can find you.
You can find me at www.staticnat.com or on Twitter at JoshO'Brien77. That's O'Brien. And this following week, I think I'm going to be doing lots of school installs. We're coming up on August and school starting and a lot of projects coming to an end.
Dan, anything from you?
Yeah, no, I'm just working on a bit of data center expansion at the moment. So equipment's piling into on trucks at the moment. So I've got to get a few bits and pieces completed.
Okay.
You should keep me busy.
And Dan's at blog.alorin, olorin.co.uk, and his Twitter handle is danhughes1234ie, or you can go and look that up on the blog post this week if you want to see. I don't want that spelled out. Ethan, what's happening with
I let you say it.
Oh, this week I'm going to continue on my network foundation rebuild, you know, the ground up review of everything. And I'm also trying to get serious about my CCIE research studies. I did book the test for the end of October, so I got to get my nose in the book and get going on reviewing all those details that kind of fall out of your brain after you forget the lab, after you pass the lab. So I'll hopefully have some more blog posts about some of that stuff and so on. And okay. I'll also be traveling to Salt Lake City for a wedding at the end of this week. Very exciting.
Outstanding. Hopefully we're going to still hear you on the show next weekend. And for me, this week I've been spending my time planning out the Netfield Day in San Jose coming up in mid-September. And if anybody's got any questions or any information, please ping me an email and I'll be there to help you out. Of course, I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me at etherealmind.com or on Twitter at etherealmind. We would love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send us an email to packetpushers@gmail.com and let us know what you're thinking. We've used your feedback to form the show arrangement and to talk about topics. We do listen, and we do try to get back to you. We are busy. We do actually have real jobs during the day, so please bear with us if we don't get back to you straight away. Out the podcast website at http://packetpushers.net and leave comments on today's show. Abuse us, but preferably be nice. You can also follow us on Twitter at @packetpushers. And remember, too much networking would never be enough.